This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flint.
Well, Margaret, the White House placed another spotlight on the nation's opioid crisis, designating the third week in September as Prescription Opioid and Heroin Epidemic Awareness Week. The crisis is still claiming more than 70 lives per day.
The president used the designation as a way to educate the public about new measures that are being enacted from multiple federal agencies.
The president has requested $1.1 billion to pay for the ongoing crisis, especially for community-based interventions and for providing more treatment space for addicts seeking help. At a news conference this week, White House drug czar Michael Botticelli, Attorney General Loretta Lynch, and families who've lost loved ones to the drug scourge demanded that Congress take action for the funding now.
Seems like there's a real coordinated effort across multiple agencies to try and reach into the hardest hit communities that are affected by this deadly crisis, and several new efforts underway. The USDA is reaching out to bolster rural communities that lack access to treatment facilities, designating their 2,100 field offices as resource centers.
The Department of Justice is reaching out to law enforcement entities across the country to better train them to confront those suffering from addiction. They've also launched a targeted strategy to interrupt the flow of fentanyl, the latest and most lethal opioid in the illicit drug market, which has led to huge spikes in overdose.
And the White House is making this a top priority across the spectrum of federal agencies. It's the kind of directive and effort that we really have to see if we're going to confront this crisis head on a national basis.
And today's guest is fighting a battle of a different sort, Margaret. Dr. John Ioannidis is one of the nation's leading meta researchers. He's been battling the lack of true evidence-based research across the scientific and medical communities.
Well, we are looking forward to that. And Lori Robertson will be stopping by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She looks at false claims spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, remember, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. John Ioannidis in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Health insurance costs are continuing to hit Americans in the pocket at higher rates. While the premium rates are going up on the Obamacare exchanges, a recent Kaiser Family Foundation study found employees who get insurance through their companies are taking perhaps more of a hit. According to the Kaiser survey, premiums have risen 20% since 2011. And for the first time, more than half of covered employees are paying a deductible of over $1,000 per year in addition to their out-of-pocket contribution to their health plans. Many companies try to offset those increases through wellness programs and health assessment initiatives. Non-smokers and those who participate in wellness initiatives can earn credits towards their monthly premiums. But higher out-of-pocket costs for all consumers is becoming the new norm, according to Kaiser. In a bold shift in policy, the FDA has approved a new treatment for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, a rare progressive genetic disorder that hampers muscle movement, eventually killing most sufferers by the age of 30. The experimental drug, which has yielded data suggesting only moderate efficacy, was promoted heavily by researchers and families who claim it has some effect on a subset of DMD patients. Former FDA lead reviewer Dr. Ronald Farkas quit his post over the approval, saying it sets a bad precedent for other experimental treatments that could put patients at greater risk for harm. The FDA's official position on the approval is that it shows the agency can be flexible when considering treatment options for patients with rare life-threatening conditions who lack any other viable treatment. Florida's Governor Rick Scott held a press conference in the middle of the first neighborhood struck with the Zika virus, saying it has been eradicated from the Wynwood neighborhood of Miami. Scott saying a targeted effort of pesticide spraying and removing standing water has led them to deem the region Zika-free. But CDC officials are saying not so fast. Miami-Dade County is still experiencing new Zika infections, including 5 new cases recently in Miami Beach. U.S. health officials are still urging pregnant women to consider putting off non-essential travel to Miami. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention left in place a travel warning issued for nearby Miami Beach due to local transmission of a mosquito-borne virus that can cause serious birth defects. And sorry, kids, you may have to cry over that spill spilled milk or dropped donut after all. A two-year study seeking to answer the burning question, does the five-second rule apply to food dropped on the floor? Turns out it does not. Researchers at Rutgers University concluded no matter how quickly you pick up that bonbon off the floor, it will have new bacteria attached to it. Researchers wanted to rigorously test the largely folklore-driven notion that a food could not be contaminated in under 5 seconds and was therefore safe to eat off the floor. So they dropped a number of foods from watermelon to gummy candies, tested 4 contact times, less than 1 second, and 5 up to 300 seconds. While the research found the 5-second rule has some validity in that longer contact times resulted in more transfer of bacteria, but no fallen food escaped contamination completely. The study concluded bacteria can contaminate instantaneously. Bad news for hungry people, great news for the family dog. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with John Ioannidis, the C.F. Renberg Professor in Disease Prevention at Stanford University School of Medicine and Professor of Health Research and Policy and Epidemiology and Statistics at Stanford, where he is also co-director of the Meta Research Innovation Center. Dr. Ioannidis is perhaps best known for his 2005 paper, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False. A prolific writer and editor, he's the editor-in-chief of the European Journal of Clinical Investigation. The Atlantic selected Ioannidis as the Brave Thinker Scientist for 2010, claiming that he may be one of the most influential scientists alive. He earned his medical degree at the University of Athens School of Medicine, did his residency at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Ioannidis, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for the very kind invitation.
Clearly, you're a champion in the field of meta research and have become one of the world's leading warriors in the quest for better evidence-based science, which your research has shown is sorely lacking in many disciplines, including medicine. In fact, you recently wrote an essay to the effect entitled Evidence-Based Medicine Has Been Hijacked. And then I wonder if you could tell our listeners about your work in meta-research, especially as it relates to evidence-based medicine.
So evidence-based medicine is one of the best ideas that science and indeed practical application of medicine. It has always aimed to combine the best evidence, the best data, in trying to get the best possible outcome. So over the years, lots of scientists have struggled to improve both fronts. So both the quality and quantity of evidence, as well as the way that we interpreted and applied into clinical circumstances to serve single patients or, you know, if it's public health or public health decisions. We have also realized in that process that evidence is unfortunately susceptible to various biases, to various errors that result in inferences that are incorrect, sometimes conflicted. So there has been a lot of interest about how to improve our evidence in a scientific way. Meta-research is specifically aiming to cover that niche, to study the process of science, the process of research practices, and the process that evidence is being collected, sometimes synthesized, presented, analyzed, interpreted, and how we can minimize the biases and the inefficiencies of the process.
Well, Dr. Ioannidis, it's not that many years since the term evidence-based medicine really took root in our lexicon of healthcare, but you say that such a thing doesn't really exist in a standardized, reliable way. What protocols of research do you think are required to achieve better evidence-based results? You know, more importantly, the meta question is, how do frontline clinicians know what results and what research to trust?
So currently we're doing research that much of the time, even if we do it correctly, it will not really yield the answers that we want. So we want more patient-relevant and pragmatic research. Then who is doing this research? You know, very often we rely on research that is done or sponsored by stakeholders who have a clear conflict of interest in getting a particular type of result. So selecting who is the organization or the scientist or the sponsor for different types of research that fuel that evidence is extremely important. Lots of the studies that we do are pretty ambitious and they just die off. And so we know that they will die off. We just cannot convince ourselves that the vast majority of research that is being done is pretty fragmented pieces of small studies that may well be completed, but even when they're completed, we know that the answer that we will get will be inconclusive or worse. We get lots of selective reporting in the process and are not reliable. And finally, I think it's an issue of transparency. If, for example, an outside scientist wants to check what has been done, what would happen if we had access to these raw data? I think the main reason for that is to enhance trust and also improve the utility of this collected information that can be used also for other purposes, to synthesize it along with other studies and to try to get more reliable results.
Dr. Ioannidis, let's talk about how we got here. You say that in the 90s, the key tool for non-evidence-based medicine was used to splendidly serve special interest, and that research was oftentimes just simply opinion leaders or drug reps. Very little about those early so-called research initiatives were properly called in question. Now you say we have much better data, much better research, but we still have bad directives. And what, if anything, has improved in this new era of metadata analysis?
So we have grown out of a system of expert-based medicine where we had very limited information and lots of expert opinion to a system that currently we have lots of data much of the time, or at least we have lots of studies, not necessarily very informative, though. These studies can still be conflicted, so they can still be affected by their sponsors, by the manufacturers very often of drugs that sponsor, for example, clinical trials of drugs. But then there are some characteristics that we want to see in a piece of clinical research in particular. We want to make sure that we do research about things that have a problem base. There's a problem to solve. There's a lot of research that is done about problems that don't exist, or actually they even create problems that kind of torture people and scientists and researchers who continue to do more and more studies. The second major component is that if we start some new research project, we want to make sure that we already know what has been done. And currently, there's a lot of disconnect between the knowledge of what has been done and the design of new studies. And ideally, they should be part of the same process. They should be integrated, and any new study should belong to that ongoing, living, systematic review or meta-analysis. In many fields where you can design the research agenda ahead of time, you can think of a meta-analysis as being equivalent to the primary research. And then you're building the pieces of various studies that you want to put together their evidence from. The third component is that some studies are designed in a way that even if everything goes well, they will not be informative. So it's an issue of what is the information gain. Most of the studies that we do are very small. They are unlikely to really help us, no matter what the results are. Some people actually, as I said, are even inclined to manipulate the results, not necessarily in a fraudulent way, but maybe in a creative or exploratory way to try to get results that are more dramatic. But still, this is not informative and could also be misleading. And we should have information gained regardless of whether the results are positive or negative, because if we only have information gained, if we get positive results, then we are inclined to get the results no matter what, to be positive. We need patient relevance. We need to study things that are important to patients, and very often we don't ask patients. We just think that we know, but actually we haven't asked the patients, what is it really that matters to you? You know, the things that matter to scientists may not be necessarily the ones that matter to patients. We've seen that very often when scientists or clinicians become patients, they realize how different and it is to be a patient compared to treat patients or deal with patients without really having a clue what is really important to them. We need pragmatism. We need to do research that is embedded in reality, in real life, not highly hypothetical and technical environments. Many studies are done in a way that they select some very special setting and some very special patients with very special characteristics. And then the question is, if we get some answer, is that going to be applicable to the average patient? We need visibility, as I mentioned earlier, and we have evidence that lots of clinical trials don't get anywhere. Probably about 30% of them don't get anywhere, and when it comes to other types of studies, the results are higher than that. We need value for money. Money is scarce, unfortunately, for research, and since the situation is unlikely to change radically, we need to make sure that we spend our resources wisely so Am I likely to affect clinical care or clinical practice in a way that I will get more than my original investment? And we also need transparency. So we do have access to data, to protocols. We can double check what has happened. We can integrate information. We can have trust. I think that improving trust in research, in particular in clinical research, is extremely important.
Well, Dr. Ioannidis, I wonder if we might talk for a few moments about your own research. You yourself have candidly stated that it's sometimes led to conclusions that could be called into question, and you gave as an example a large study your team conducted in Sweden, utilizing Sweden's very robust national health database, seeking possible links between some 50 different prescription medications and the incidence of cancers. And I understand your group did a meta-analysis of the data. What did the data reveal, and how does it illustrate just how challenging this process of evidence-based science really is?
I'm very much interested to test different methods myself and to make sure that I make these errors and I can recognize them. So I have done lots of studies that I'm just trying to understand how a specific type of design might work. So as to try to see what could go wrong. And in the example that you mentioned, this is a study that we did indeed with data from Sweden. Sweden has a wonderful system that collects information on the entire population. And this means that you can have information, for example, on all the prescriptions that have been given, and you can have also information on all the cancers that have been diagnosed. Not easy currently to address the question of whether a drug causes cancer using randomized trials, because you need a very long follow-up and you need a very time. So lots of that work is done with observational designs. So we decided to look at all the drugs because we had that data set available, so we could look at the associations of any drug against cancer risk. And we could do that in different methodological approaches. We could do it with different types of designs. So if you run these associations with these mega big data and with these extensive, as we call, exposure-wide association analysis, you come up with hundreds of drugs that have extremely strong statistical support for association with cancer risk. But there are several problems. One is that there are just too many. And it's very hard to believe that just 50% of the drugs are causing cancer. But, you know, this is what the statistics would show. Number two, the results would be very different compared to the first analysis if you run a different analysis with a different model. So the first analysis would suggest here are the 100 drugs that cause cancer. A different analysis with a different statistical model will give you a completely different set. And the third is just the impressive statistics that you get that nevertheless are not believable. So if you have a huge sample size, you can get p-values that are infinitesimally small. But most of the time, they just mean nothing. So we also compared these results against a meta-analysis of data that have been already done, trying to assess whether particular drugs are causing or protecting from specific cancers, and very, very slim evidence about such associations. In the past, the key problem was small studies that were non-informative and easy to distort. Now we have a second superimposed problem. Sometimes we can have very large studies that can still be very misleading because they have extreme power. They're overpowered to detect statistical signals that don't necessarily correspond to clinical reality.
We're speaking today with John Ioannidis, the C.F. Renberg Professor in Disease Prevention at Stanford University School of Medicine. He's the co-director of the Meta Research Innovation Center at Stanford and was named by Atlantic as one of the most influential scientists alive. Dr. Ioannidis, your lauded 2005 paper, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False, didn't earn you many fans, and your piece in Atlantic continued to call the scientific community into question with the piece Lies, Damn Lies in Medical Science. You know, I was, as you were talking about those eight standards for good research, starting sort of with the fundamental question is, what's the problem to be fixed, all the way to transparency, I couldn't help but think about a couple of high-profile cases of perhaps misappropriated research. Front page of the New York Times just the last week, a 50-year-old Harvard study, they forgot to mention it was sponsored by the sugar industry, which falsely absolved sugar as a culprit in heart health. And And then really the lack of any research on the part of Theranos as they rolled out a very exciting diagnostic testing imagery. I wonder if you could talk about these examples.
So the sugar example is a very nice one. It shows how you can have highly prestigious scientists by one of the top institutions in the world really be affected by a particular sponsor who is supporting their research to try to formulate a research literature that is supportive of what the sponsor wants to hear. So it's something that happened a long time ago, and the standards of transparency have changed enormously since then. I think that probably there were many, many such cases in the past that did happen. Back then, there was absolutely no need by journals for researchers and authors to be transparent. So it's not that they failed the standards. They didn't fail the standards that were in place. But this is a very common phenomenon. It's very common to see research being supported by sponsors. Mm-hmm. It's not easy to change the data or create fake data because that would be outright fraud. Mm-hmm. But it's much easier to interpret the data in a way that would suit the needs of the sponsor. And I think that there's many other industries that have been equally, quote-unquote, good or effective at doing the same. And over the years, we're seeing more of that penetration of different conflicts because many stakeholders have started to ask for more transparency in the process. So we do see more conflicts being declared. And I think we should also be careful not to reach the other extreme and go into a spree of witch hunting and say that every researcher is conflicted and every industry is just trying to create a misleading literature. Mm-hmm. I think that there's potential for distortion. It doesn't mean that we should see distortion everywhere. Mm-hmm. We really want to make sure that we minimize that influence whenever possible. I think that it's a problem in many other areas. You mentioned diagnostic tests or other entities. It can happen with drugs. It can happen with other technologies. Whenever there is a conflict, either financial or some sort of belief system or some expectation.
Well, Dr. Ioannidis, it's clear that you also see the potential for improvement. So I'd like to ask you to maybe just talk a bit about the work that you are doing as co-director of the Meta Research Innovation Center at Stanford.
The aim of Metrics, our center, is to try to create a hub around how to improve research practices, how to improve the way that we do research, the way that we evaluate research, the way that we interpret research, the way that we reward research, the way that we can minimize biases and lead to more efficient processes with more reliable results. So it's a very ambitious effort. And when we started, I just couldn't tell how far that could reach. And I have been so pleasantly surprised to see that there's so much interest, not only within our own field, but across the spectrum of the sciences, not only biomedical, but also social and economics and psychology and mathematics and physical sciences. And there's just an enormous amount of talent around the world of leading scientists who have started to think very seriously about how can we optimize research. So we are trying to build that field. If you go to any university, you will not see a department of meta research being there. But there's so much interest and so many scientists working in so different departments who are interested in these questions that I think that their combined forces could really generate a lot of evidence and a lot of possibilities about how to improve research practices, how we do science in a way that we can make it more efficient, more reliable, more credible, that we eventually, in the case of medical research, also help people in the best possible way. There's many initiatives in the space of transparency, data sharing, registration of studies, fidelity in reporting of outcomes, improve statistical tools and statistical methods, promote some better statistical approaches, try to improve the way that we reevaluate scientists and the way we promote them in a way that scientists will develop research portfolios that would really be useful and helpful, and try to find better ways to review research, make that more transparent, more open, more reliable, see whether review can be improved at different levels, at the level of pre-publication, or it could be even post-publication. Improve transparency, minimize conflicts of interest, think about new models of how to do research and how to fund research. And it's just an amazing environment. There are so many great scientists who are really putting their minds together in thinking about how to improve each and all of these processes.
That sounds like an exciting frontier, and we are happy to be speaking with Dr. John Ioannidis, co-director of the Meta Research Innovation Center at Stanford. You can find more about his work by going to metrics.stanford.edu. Dr. Ioannidis, thank you so much for the work that you do and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you again for the wonderful questions.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Donald Trump falsely claimed that Hillary Clinton has no child care plan. In fact, Clinton's proposals for child care and paid family leave have been posted on her campaign website for months. Despite that fact, Trump's daughter Ivanka also claimed in an interview on Fox News that there was, quote, no policy on Hillary Clinton's website on child care, elder care, or parental leave. Clinton's campaign website contains a child care and early childhood education plan calling for universal access to preschool for four-year-olds within 10 years and a doubling of the federal investment in Early Head Start and the Early Head Start Child Care Partnership Program. Those are child development programs and support programs for children under age 3 and pregnant women. Clinton's website also has a separate plan for 12 weeks of paid family and medical leave. Ivanka Trump also incorrectly said in an interview with ABC News that all of her father's thousands of employees had a paid maternity leave benefit. They don't, according to the Trump Organization and reporting by the Huffington Post. The Huffington Post reported that employees at several Trump hotels said they don't get paid maternity leave, and a statement from the Trump Organization said that while the company has an 8-week paid parental leave policy, quote, policies and practices allowing employees to enjoy a healthy work-life balance vary from property to property. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. 1 in 6 people in the world lacks access to drinking water or basic sanitation, and statistics show that diarrhea is the leading cause of death for these populations, but access to clean and potable water continues to present a real challenge. In Africa, the numbers are staggering, with 46% of the residents of sub-Saharan Africa having no direct access to clean water. In 2005, artist Tracy Hawkins went to Tanzania to see what she could do about it. Clay pot water filtration has been around for several hundred years, where simple clay pots lined in the bottom with silver oxide can remove up to 99% of the impurities from most water sources, but no one had undertaken a dedicated program to produce and distribute these pots. Tracy founded the Singisi Pottery Project with a local activist and began making the pots with local artisans in this region of Tanzania. By 2008, she and her team were able to get a factory built so that they could increase production. The project has served multiple communities and continues to expand. Independent researchers have determined the system to be safe, effective, and the best part, the health of entire communities has been improved significantly. The pots are inexpensive to produce, easy to handle, and the factory has also created jobs for local residents. They have since changed the name of the organization to Safe Water Ceramics of East Africa and have continued plans to replicate their successful model across the region. a simple, easily manufactured solution that improves access to potable water for a community that previously had few options, one that improves health, well-being, and economic conditions at the same time. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.